Thanks,
Righty,
Brother.
good morning, everybody. Welcome. If you are our guest today, we're so thankful that you came to be with us. We're thankful for our brothers and sisters in the Lord, and thankful that we have a family of the Lord's people who are a part of our lives that we work alongside and are encouraged by as we go along each week. We're thinking from the little letter of James about the particular applications our faith has to our lives at home, to our lives in our families. Today I ask you to think with me about a part of this story which everyone will be able to identify with, the temptations that we face and the way they impact our lives at home. Someone said, opportunity knocks once, but temptation leans on the doorbell. I don't mean by that you only get one opportunity in life, and if you miss it, you're ruined. I believe the Lord gives us opportunities as we go along. But I do agree with what this says about the persistence of temptation in our lives. One old boy developed his own amplified version of the Lord's model prayer. It had in it, "Lead me not into temptation. I can find that well enough on my own." You can understand what he was saying. One fellow decided one day to try to journal the kinds of temptations, how many temptations he faced in an ordinary day, and then to try to think about how those things touched his family. This is a fairly extensive list. Number one, staying in bed late and letting somebody else attend to the chores of life, the temptation to laziness. Number two, showing up at the breakfast table grouchy, growling at the table, the temptation to unkindness. Next, arguing over who should change the baby this time, the temptation of selfishness. Next, the devoting of every waking hour either to trying to get stuff for myself or to be entertained myself, the temptation of idolatry. Next, starting to work 20 minutes late, extending every break time and leaving early, the temptation to slothfulness. Then losing your temper at a coworker who doesn't do it the way you thought he should have, the temptation to impatience and littleness. Next, flirting with that good-looking woman or lingering eye contact with that good-looking man, the temptation to unfaithfulness. Then refusing to speak to a person who has hurt you before, the temptation to malice. Repeating a juicy story of your neighbor's weaknesses around the office group, the temptation to tale-bearing or gossip. Then taking your frustration out on the children after a hard day, the temptation of immaturity and inconsideration. Then retreat to your screen time, either of the TV or the computer or the phone, the temptation of isolation and self-absorption. Then the messages that are taken in on those screens, either the temptation of the spirit of the age or absorption with the anxiety over news and world events. And then lying awake at night, stewing over your plans for the next day and worrying over how to get what you want and how to keep what you get, the temptation of materialism. Can you identify with any of that? It's hard to be a family and not to know what that guy's talking about and maybe to have some of the same things on our list. So how do we protect our homes against where temptation could take us? We can't keep from being tempted. That happens. How can we protect our families against where the temptation could take us? I appreciate James on this. James asks us to think a little deeper than the episode of the tempting to the cause of it. And he gets very real about what happens in the process. And I think James, at least I think, is more hopeful about the whole thing and what the outcome could be than we may sometimes be. We take it like fate. James doesn't. He thinks we have a choice about what we do. Look at James 1, verses 13 through 15. James writes, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death." I believe there are some things in that text that can help every family sitting here this morning, mine included, yours as well. So let's take from this some principles that we maybe can use in our lives. First off, just observe from what James says that temptation is what happens at the stress point between faith and self. That's the whole context in which James is speaking to us. On the one hand, there are the assumptions and actions of faith in the Lord, faith in God. And in our case, in our studies through this month of December, there are also the applications that we have found in James to everyday living in a family setting. For example, faith involves the assumption that male and female and mother and father and leaving and holding fast and being husband and wife and parent-child are all God's wise good gifts, and that submitting ourselves to His rule will in the long run establish an atmosphere which allows those good gifts to flourish. Faith involves the demonstrating of respect for persons who are made in the likeness of God in a family setting each day, and persons who are valued by Him and who are accountable to Him. And showing that respect becomes to us the sacred work of every family, every household. Faith is the daily thing that is done by paying attention and by ruling our own spirits and our own words and doing what we should ourselves and talking to bless the people that we love most and that we live with all the time. That's faith. On the other hand, James says there is ego, there is selfish ambition or desire. There are our own desires, as the way James says it. This English translation may not be the best way of saying it. It's not just natural desires. It's our desires that are selfish in their motivation and improper in their object and unholy in their fulfillment. That's the reason the word gets translated lust. Temptation, that the word James uses in verses 13 and following, is the same word that has been translated trial from verse 2 on through the rest of this chapter up to now. The only difference is the trial comes from an external force brought to bear on our lives, and the temptation comes, James says, from an internal force. That internal force being selfish desire, the satisfying of which would either use somebody or do harm to somebody else. And temptation is when those things begin to preoccupy us and become imaginable and to be the tone of our life. Temptation begins to say, at this stress point between faith and self. That identity and those rules are not necessary for you, and they're not necessarily good. You should be able to do what you want to do without having to think about other people. They don't respect you. Pay attention to your own feelings and say whatever you think. It's your life, and if it's not making you happy right now, do what you want. That's what happens at that conflict point between self and faith. Now, that leads to this second observation. Temptation is brought on often by a trial, and it's urged on by the tempter. Now, neither the trial or the tempter is specifically mentioned just in verses 13 and 15, which I've read. But they're here, and their place in this story should be understood if we're going to survive in our families. James has been discussing the trials the Lord's people face because of their faith all through chapter 1. And he brings them up again in the last chapter, the things that we have to endure or overcome in our lives. In chapter 4, he will go ahead to say, resist the devil, verse 7. That's the tempter. His work is implied here in chapter 1, though he himself is not mentioned. He likes it that way. He likes to not be obvious in it. He likes for these thoughts where self challenges faith to kind of go on without him being an obvious player in the story. It's interesting here in the verses surrounding the ones we've read, James three times talks to his beloved brothers about not being deceived, misled. Verse 16, verse 22, verse 26. Now, the trials can be any number of things. They can be the ordinary things that happen to us because we're human and we're going the way of all the earth. They can be the big tragedies that invade our lives and shock us with the unexpected. They can simply be the frustration that comes from trying to manage a two-fold life from day to day. What trial and the tempter place at issue is not simply a specific deed here or there, but what we think of God and what place we're willing for God to have in our own life. Now, it's crucial to see this point. What the tempter is after is not just to get me or you to do something improper. He's interested in impacting what we think of God. And what James is dealing with in the verses here, you can almost hear the subtle, deceptive suggestion he makes. God's not present in your life. He doesn't have your best interest at heart. He's not actively going to help you. In fact, he may be bringing this trial on you. This is his doing. That's why James has to say God is not tempted. He's not going to tempt you to do evil. God can't be. That's not his nature. But Satan is subtly saying, therefore, you don't need to listen to anything he says. Now, those may not be the exact words, but they're definitely the messages. Temptation is persuasion that satisfying your own will make you happier than keeping faith with the Lord in His will. That's the persuasion that goes on. For you can see where the temptation originates. You can see kind of what's at stake there. And then number three, temptation may be packaged situationally. What I mean by that, it may look different from when you're young than it does when you get older. There may be different stages in your marriage or as your kids grow when temptation will be packaged to suit the occasion. But its persuasion is limited and seems to always be the same. Please think about this. Whether it's Eve in the garden in Genesis 3, or whether it's Jesus in the wilderness in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, the approaches of temptation are the same ones that end up being read, named by John. Just a few verses from where Gene read at the Lord's Supper today. A few verses later, 1 John 2, verses 15 through 17. There's the lust of the flesh. That is, what is desired because the animal part of us wants it, and we think it'll make us feel good. There's the lust of the eyes, meaning that which looks like it is desirable, which appeals to our senses, and which we think we therefore either have to do or have. And then there's the pride of life. That's what makes us think we would look good, or we would look important, or we would look good, maybe it's what makes us think, I'm going to have that good thing, I'm going to keep it. Maybe that's the pride of life also. The ESV translates it pride of possession, meaning I own this, it is mine, it always will be. I have it secured, you see. Now, of course, the danger for our families is that each of these approaches, when it's occasioned by the events in our lives, the stages at which we have to live, what goes on in a human being during those different stages, gets stirred by the tempter and then harbored by the self. This is harbored, H-A-R-B-O-R, for anybody sitting here wondering. Harbored by the self, and then begins to pose a danger to the family. I can almost imagine this like advertising. I can repeat the phrases, the way in which the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life approaches us. Listen to some of this. The lust of the flesh. You're tired and bored, and you'll never have what you want. You don't want to have to bear these responsibilities and these burdens and be tied down by these routines your whole life. You should have a little pleasure for yourself. Drink this. Smoke that. Makes no difference how it impacts your kids. It's not an issue. There's the lust of the eyes. Man, look at her. Click on that picture. Watch that clip. Did you see her eyes, how she looked at you? She always looked so nice. You never have any problems around her like you do at home. Or maybe on the same vein, a different application. Oh, man, that's a nice car. That's a beautiful house. If you live there, if you could drive that, you just have to have that, no matter what. Or there's the pride of life. Everything depends on you. You know that. You're more important than anybody else in that place. You deserve more attention than you're getting. It's not fair that you're not treated better than that. You're getting somewhere in your life. Or maybe on the other hand, the the bad side of it, even the low side of the same problem. You're not important. You have no power. People never notice you. You're not as good as. Now what happens when a family hears, or family members hears those messages replayed in mind and heart over and over and over and over again? What happens? Now let's turn in a little different direction. But temptation is not sin unless it is nurtured and acted upon. This is a hugely important part of the story. Notice what James says is happening when we're being tempted. Desire is allowed to lure and entice. Both of these are words of the hunter and the fisherman. The baiting of a trap and trying to draw the other creature into it to his own demise. Or the baiting of the hook, where mama fish brings her little school of fish along behind her. I know that's not how they operate, but just imagine it is. And she's already told them, you all stay in a group, do not look that way or that way, and do not get out from behind me. But over there, there's that juicy worm, and it looks like so good, and she's not watching, and I can get there and get right back without her even noticing. And it turns out there's a hook hidden in it. That's the lure and the entice, where temptation is allowed to affect imagination. Where I begin to think, you know, that just might be doable by me at some point. And James says, that starts its own family. Temptation conceives. And she bears a child, and that child is known as sin. The contradiction of everything that's God. And then sin has its own offspring. So you think about this. Temptation begins to have grandchildren in this order. I'm not calling any grandchild this, but there is temptation, the conception, sin, and death. Sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. Somebody said, if you've been tempted by evil, fly from it. It's not falling into the water, but lying in it that drowns. You think about this. Jesus was tempted, and yet he was sinless. Paul said temptation is common to man. John read it a while ago. But he was advising his readers at the time that we don't have to fall because of it. We can escape it. And James likewise is not passing a sentence here upon us. He's just calling us to not let temptation conceive and ruin our families. So an obvious question, all right then, how do we escape it? I read about a little boy who was in the country grocery store, and he happened upon one of the aisles. Someone had opened a box of cookies, and the cookie box is open there, and the little fella is just standing by it, and he's looking, you know, he can't bring himself to kind of go on. The grocer sees him, and the grocer approaches him and said, son, what are you doing? Nothing. And the guy said, well, looks like you're trying to take some of my cookies. And the little boy said, you're wrong, mister. I'm trying not to. So how do we not give in to this? Well, we can do it like Jesus did. First, when temptation approached, Jesus seems to have drawn near to His Father in prayer. In Luke 3, verse 21, Jesus is baptized and is praying. Then there's the long section of genealogy, and in Luke 4, verse 1, Jesus is in the wilderness to be tempted. Prayer needs to accompany the approach of temptation. In the garden, Garden of Gethsemane now, as the hour of darkness was approaching, Jesus prayed to His Father, and He advised His disciples to watch and pray, lest temptation overcome them. Luke 22, verses 40 to 42. And then James, in chapter 4, will shortly say to his readers, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. Draw near to God, and He'll draw near to you. Pray ahead of time, and pray in the midst of it, and draw near to God and be close to Him. But then also, in resisting the tempter, Jesus responded to the tempter's messages by sending messages of His own to the tempter. Messages that were written on His heart long before that moment of temptation. And messages that we need to be able to speak in behalf of our families, each of us. What I want to do, without taking the time to go read the whole text, is just to use Jesus' answers to the tempter in Luke 4 to try to speak for my family. And here's the way it might sound. Satan, we believe that neither our lives, nor our strength, nor our satisfaction, nor anything that sustains us comes by bread alone. We understand that knowing the will and the heart of our Father, God, is the real nourishment by which we live. And we're not going to leave it, that is, His Word, for momentary gratification. Can you say that for your family, as a member of your family? Second, tempter, our conviction is that God is worthy of the glory and the honor and of the power, and that He comes first in our lives. And we intend to serve Him and to be loyal to Him no matter what. The conviction in our home is that we should worship and serve Him and Him alone. And we understand that there is not a shortcut to what God alone can offer to us. Remember, Satan was trying to get Jesus to cast himself down and so forth. Can you say that for your family? Third, Jesus says to the devil, that God is the Lord our God, and we respect Him and love Him and trust Him enough to not think that we need to put Him to the test, to make Him prove anything more to us, or to see how far we can go and what we can get by with. That'd be Luke 4, verses 9 through 12. And you know, the devil ran from those messages then, and he will now. But we have to actually think those thoughts and send those messages for the sake of our families. Temptation may lean on our doorbells, so let's choose not to answer. I read about one Sunday when there'd been a service and it had been over some topic like this, and the people were leaving out, and the preacher, and trying to be a little funny, maybe says to one little boy coming out, "Son, does the devil ever tell you to do bad things?" And the little boy looked at the guy and said, "Yes, but Jesus tells him to shut up." Martin Luther had a way of speaking very graphically in his descriptions of the activities of the devil. He was asked one time how he went about overcoming the tempter then. And Luther is said to have answered, "Well, when he comes knocking on the door of my heart and asks, 'Who lives here?' the dear Lord goes to the door and says, 'Martin Luther used to live here, but he's moved out. Now I live here.' And the devil, seeing the nail prints in his hand and the pierced side, takes flight immediately." In a way, that's why we're here today. We're deciding who lives in our hearts. That'll be the main thing as we meet temptation going through this week, and we surely will. Who lives there? Who's at home in your life? Who rules there? Whose place is it? The wonder of it is you can decide. You can decide who the ruler is and then make your business the abiding by that decision each day. If there's anybody here today who needs to make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ, it'd be wonderful to be able to help you. If someone's here needing to confess some shortcoming or ask brothers and sisters to pray with you, that's one of the reasons for a congregation of the Lord's people. If we can help, it'd be our privilege to do so. Let us know by coming while we stand and sing.